Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to our study of Christianity for Modern Pagans. We're going to pick back up, if I can find the page here, looks like page 91. Probably wrap up today the vanity of human justice, and then go into the vanity of human reason. Now, to zoom out and give us our context, you can recall that in the first place, what Pascal slash Kraft are trying to do here is largely what we Lutherans would call law, the preaching of the law or the preaching of repentance. And you are, in that endeavor, unveiling the wretched state of humanity, not only morally in terms of sin, but also in terms of the rest of the fallen aspects of our being and our the world in which we live. So the vanity of human justice functions to show how fundamentally unjust fallen human beings are and how justice eludes us in this world continuously. But even as we see the failure to attain an earthly justice, we're met with that apologetic rationale of, well, how do you know what actual justice is, what objective justice is in the first place? So we are like that disinherited prince earlier that we discovered, I think, around page 59, where we have this idea that it should be perfect, but it's not. And we keep aspiring towards that perfection and getting frustrated. So the fact that we're frustrated by all of this, we should have just accepted it as normal. But we continue to be frustrated. We continue to strive for greater, for that perfection. So it proves that that perfection exists. So again, there's this twofold thrust. More could be made of it, but certainly this twofold thrust, revealing man's wretched estate in the first place, but then showing that by the very fact that we recognize it as wretched, we've fallen from something that isn't wretched. So that's the main theological mileage that Pascal and Kraft want to get here. Now, the same is going to be true for human reason, and that'll strike us by and large as a little bit more familiar, since along with St. Paul in 1 Corinthians 1, we Lutherans have a healthy skepticism toward fallen reason and certainly understand its limitations. Okay, so before we jump back into the vanity of human justice, let's have our invocation and prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. All right, on page 91, Ponce 81, the only universal rules are the law of the land in everyday matters and the will of the majority in others. How is that? Because of the power implied. And if we just jump down to Crave's commentary, he'll shed further light on this. The de facto universal is not justice, but power. Whether located in the will of one or in the will of many. A democracy can be just as totalitarian as a monarchy. Rousseau's general will can be and has been far more powerful and repressive than any dictator in history. So this is a reality of the world in its fallen state that might determines what is right, so to speak, that whoever has the will and the ability, the power to enforce their will, that becomes definitional for what quote-unquote justice is. So justice per se is not universal, but power is, and it lies underneath everything in the fallen world. Okay, so once more with Pascal, the only universal rules are the law of the land in everyday matters and the will of the majority in others. How is that? Because of the power implied. As men could not make might obey right, they have made right obey might. As they could not fortify justice, they have justified force. And here is Crave's reflection B. The central political point of the most famous political book ever written, Plato's Republic, is that wisdom and power must join. Therefore, philosophers must rule. Plato could not make might obey right, even when he tried it in Syracuse, nor can anyone else. Why? Poncet 103 tells us why. Next. The ancient sophists like Thrasymachos, the Renaissance sophist Machiavelli, and the modern sophists like most sociologists have a point. All societies do, in fact, enact justice by power. Mao Zedong put it with elegant bluntness, justice comes out of the barrel of a gun. Peace is created by war, justice by injustice, as Machiavelli argues in The Prince. The foundation of all states which make the laws is force. Rome was founded on Romulus' murder of his brother Remus, just as all of our history began with Cain's murder of his brother Abel. Pascal is as brutally realistic as the Bible. Okay, so this is uncomfortable because we all acknowledge it to be true to one degree or another, and if not, then frankly that's a product of our own naive times, the Pax Americana. But the vanity of human justice is on full display by the fact that justice can simply be overturned when you have a majority to overturn it or enough power to overturn it. So that is a rather fickle expression or instantiation of justice. Thus, it is vain in this fallen world and rendered vain by violence. Okay, any thoughts you have on this bright, happy, rainbows and butterflies kind of...
Magistrate wielding that power is of good heart.
Correct.
And a moral person.
Correct. 100%. Yeah. Yeah, and that's really the why we want and pray for, like the Catechism teaches in the Lord's Prayer, that we're praying for faithful rulers, because faithful rulers can also have enormous influence both by coercion and by appeal to the masses, so that righteous rulers can make a righteous people and unrighteous rulers can make an unrighteous people. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I'm thinking of movies and basically what we watch. Back in the day when I was young, you know, the Western movie, that good would always prevail, and there seemed to be justice, a thread of that through the presentation. And they say movies are a mirror of society, and now just this wave and just gauntlet, I mean, a huge amount of evil winning out. So it seems like that has, and why people seem to want to be drawn to that, watching series like Law and Order and so forth. There's just this, we seek to watch justice or the function of it. Mm-hmm. Even the evening news is loaded with these things. So I'm just commenting on how we as society watch this, either indirectly or, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I think we could spend hours talking about it because it's so interesting and so fun, so psychologically intriguing. I think the rise of popularity in Westerns when they were popular is very interesting, because so many, gosh, it'd be hard to think of one that doesn't have this premise. The Wild West, a breach in law and order, and in comes someone who's going to bring law and order, but he's got to do so through force. Through force. And it's interesting to have that being played out on the screen while what's happening to our country is what's happening. It's almost inoculating, you know. It's almost like you're living in this fantasy land, living out a fantasy instead of doing it in the real world. But yeah, that's I like your perspective, and it causes us to reflect on these things. But even our heroes are restoring justice or righteousness or law and order, but they have to do so through violence. Yeah. Okay, any other thoughts you have? So on to Ponce 103, which Kraft has already pointed out is intimately connected in terms of its thought. Right without might is helpless. Might without right is tyrannical. So obviously these are just aphorisms, thought-provoking assertions. Right without might is challenged because there are always evil men about. Might without right is denounced. We must therefore combine right and might, and to that end make right into might or might into right. Right is open to dispute. Might is easily recognized and beyond dispute. Therefore, right could not be made mighty because might challenged right, calling it unjust and itself claiming to be just. Being thus unable to make right into might, we have made right might into right. Tongue twister there. Brain twister after a while, isn't it? Okay, so Kraft is going to give us a little commentary here, put it in plain English. It is easier to pin a new label, namely right or correct, on an old powerful thing, might, than to persuade the powerful thing to obey true labels. It is easier to pin a slogan on a cannon than to make a cannon obey a slogan. Easier for the navigator to chart a new course in accordance with how the battleship is actually moving than for the whole ship to change its course in accordance with the old charts. And there's a lot of wisdom in leadership here to be contemplated and drawn out, even though it's tangential to the conversation in the main. The conversation in the main, of course, is showing that this inescapable fallen reality of the world. And I think that the church has blundered very heavily and continues to blunder very heavily in regard to trying to suggest that might itself is the problem. That power corrupts, period, or something. I mean, this is easily demonstrably false. Who's more powerful than Christ? Is he corrupted? So it's not power itself that should be eschewed. It's power that should be wielded and used in the appropriate way. Simply because the church finds itself in a relatively powerless position doesn't mean that power itself is the enemy or that power itself should be avoided. And maybe the most egregious things I've seen in this regard have to do with the two kingdoms, the left-hand and right-hand kingdom, and these kind of bold assertions like the left-hand kingdom is the kingdom of power and the right-hand kingdom is the kingdom of grace. Doesn't make much sense if you ever read the Bible and try to force the Bible into these categories. It just doesn't make sense. In fact, I think the Book of Concord describes it very differently. Both hands of Christ, both kingdoms consist of power. The left-hand kingdom's power is the sword, and the right-hand kingdom's power is the word. That gets it right. So we're not power against anti-power or passivism, which they're calling grace, but rather we're understanding that there are two unique kinds of power to be wielded. Yes, sir.
Just clarification. So as we read that, right means rightness, I think. It's not the right of the leader to exercise power in a procedural sense.
Yeah, right is me, like just, I think.
Just and right. Mm-hmm. Right and correct. Okay.
Is there anything that we can learn from the battles of the Old Testament, especially when the Lord was cleaning out the Promised Land and how when the Israelites were right with the Lord, they were powerful.
Mm-hmm.
When they were far away from the Lord,
correct,
no power.
Correct. Yeah, I think that's a wonderful insight and a very deep theme that runs through. I think even from what Judges forward. Yeah, that's a great insight. I mean, you can put it kind of bluntly. Like, does the Jesus you worship, has he ever killed anyone? It's kind of a trick question. But many Christians would say no, and they'd be appalled by a Jesus who has killed anyone. Well, when you look at the Old Testament, Jesus is the one who goes out as the man of war and slays countless tens of thousands of enemy combatants. When you look at how Revelation depicts Jesus' return at the end of the age, not only is he riding on a white horse, but the horse's bridle has blood coming up to it, the blood of his enemies. So this idea that, like, the sword is bad, or the sword is satanic, or the sword is fallen, or violence is all of these things, is a completely unbiblical thought. And Christ himself is described as a man of war. And, I mean, of course, it's often cited, I mean, almost, but still, the overturning of the tables. There are Jesus, when he's about to be arrested in John's gospel, speaks a word and knocks everyone on their can. There are opportunities even in his earthly life and ministry, even in his so-called state of humiliation, to find that power leaping out from time to time. He's able to simply disappear and or pass through the Pharisees when they surround him to stone him. So there are exercises of his power. And of course he speaks, and even the seas are stilled and the wind and the waves obey him. His speaking is actually a rebuke. And then when you look at Jesus writing to the seven churches in Revelation, I mean, if that isn't your Jesus, then you've lost track of the biblical Jesus. And right there he speaks in incredibly demanding, strict, and in some cases even violent language. I will vomit you out, or split you out, or the language of being cut off, this kind of thing. Okay, so yeah, I think that's one of the things we have to regain in our current milieu, is that the church is not the kingdom of the powerless. What a preposterous idea. But the church's power is precisely in the word. The state's power is in the sword. But sometimes the word and the sword, those two kingdoms, have to act as one. And the Old Testament is filled with examples of that. Was Elijah in the left-hand kingdom or the right-hand kingdom when he slew and oversaw the slaying of the prophets of Baal? So your theological categories are only as good as the Bible. Isn't that what we all believe, that the Bible is the norm of all doctrine? So if our theological categories, helpful in this case or that case, cease to be helpful, we should just acknowledge that. The categories are a tool of man. They're helpful insofar as they're helpful. But where they start to jar us out of understanding the Bible itself, something's gone wrong. Okay. What other thoughts do you have? Yes, sir.
The right use of force is going to be determined by vocations, though.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I don't disagree that right is or might is not inherently bad or evil for sure, but it is used when vocationally appropriate.
Correct. And I think there's an acknowledgement of overlapping vocation that we need to be increasingly aware of that. And maybe I perceive that acutely since I'm a pastor, but it's good for the whole church to understand this. That we wear left hand and right hand vocational hats, if you like, right? And it can be extremely unhelpful if someone's beating down your door in the middle of the night and you're going, oh my goodness, am I in the left hand or the right hand kingdom? Are you here because I am a pastor or because I am just a citizen? What do you intend? Is this a martyrdom or a robbery? I think I've made my point. We have to have these things sorted out in our minds ahead of time. And again, our categories are helpful insofar as they're helpful, but sometimes it's just simply a call to act, and then someone after the fact can autopsy the category. Right? Fair enough. Okay, so in any case, here is the dilemma that is being presented. Is human justice seems to be completely just the nose on the head, and the head is violence, is power. And so whoever has the most violence or power, the monopoly, isn't that government, the monopoly on violence? Then you have justice just simply following that. And that's backwards of how it ought to be. Okay, so on to Ponce 520. I spent much of my life believing that there was such a thing as justice. Okay, and then Kraft interjects, natural law. And in this, I was not mistaken. For insofar as God has chosen to reveal it to us, there is such a thing. And then Kraft comments at B, by conscience and reason, as well as by miraculous intervention in history of Moses and the Ten Commandments. Okay. So all of that's well and good, and I appreciate Kraft's interjections here. Pascal continues, but I did not take it in this way, and that is where I was wrong. For I thought that our justice was essentially just, and that I had the means to understand and judge it. But I found myself so often making unsound judgments that I began to distrust myself and then others. I saw that all countries and all men change. Thus, after many changes of mind concerning true justice, I realize that our nature is nothing but continual change, and I have never changed since. And if I were to change, I should be confirming my opinion. Okay, so let's take a look at C. The first mistake of the idealist is confusing our justice with justice, maybe capital J there would help make the point, subjective with objective, and then positive law with natural law. Simply because a nation asserts it, we cannot take that to be natural law. That is God's created order inherent in creation. So this is like, you know, the slogan, you can't legislate morality, is in any case extremely foolish, because you end up doing just that very thing. And when you say to a people something like abortion is legal, their assumption is that abortion is okay, is morally okay. That's the assumption of the people. If it was wrong, the people who know more than me, whose responsibility it is to rule over me, would say it's wrong. So therefore, it must not be wrong. So that's a kind of example, I think, the way that Kraft and, I mean, by extension, Pascal, means positive law, or this disjoint between law and justice as we experience it. That is, quote-unquote, ours, as opposed to that which is, quote-unquote, universal or natural. And so this is the confusing with our justice subjective, with justice objective, with positive law and natural law, the point in C. All right, and then down to D. Mistake number two, forgetting the noetic. That just means like intellectual, having to do with knowledge. Forgetting the noetic consequences of sin. Not only is our practice of justice fallen, not only are our law and customs fallen, but our knowledge of true justice is also fallen and fallible. Otherwise, why would there be moral arguments and moral uncertainties? Okay, so an easy example of this is I won't make the case on the basis of natural law, though that's exactly the case that Moses makes. So maybe we'll get there. But you remember that God says to Noah, as recorded by Moses, that a man who sheds the blood of another man, his blood shall be shed. Now, we say to ourselves, even as Americans, maybe even as conservative, right-leaning Christian Americans, however you want to say it, we have a tendency to say, well, maybe not always. Or, no, I don't think that that's just. I'm against the death penalty. That would illustrate precisely Pascal's point that we, even when we are at our best, don't understand what justice is. Because God's justice seems unjust to us. Well, who's right? And if God's right, then it's our feelings. Another way, and this might be a little more complicated, but I think you'll recognize it superficially. God is constantly, especially quote-unquote God of the Old Testament, is constantly being charged with war crimes and with other moral deficiencies. By who? By a just and righteous people? So our understanding of justice that we're so self-assured of and by which we judge God is in fact itself incorrect if it condemns God. And that would articulate Pascal's point where he talks, and I think this may be the most difficult line, but now you see what he means, where he says, I found myself so often making unsound judgments that I began to distrust myself and then others. So in a world apart from God, there really is no such thing as justice. Only with God is there justice. And in recognizing that, on account of our fallen state, even that is imperfect. So we Christians readily acknowledge that. But if you're not a Christian, this is powerful apologetic, not only to the wretchedness, that the height of human justice will always be unjust, both in reality and in practice, or both, I mean, in ideologically and in practice. But then that also shows us, like that honest realization shows us that there must in fact be a perfect justice, and it resides outside of humanity. Otherwise, we wouldn't recognize the folly of our own. Yeah.
Well, I think that when philosophy invades the Bible or the church, it's like, how many times have we heard, how can you be against abortion and for the death penalty?
Yeah.
And, you know, it isn't God's righteousness. It's not God's law. It's kind of a philosophical truth where you start to parse good and bad with each other.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly a worldly fallen philosophy is the problem, but clear thinking, clear love of wisdom and the objective standpoint will sort out those challenges that are poorly reasoned and come from Satan. So I don't think, I think that that'll ultimately be the outcome of this, is that we, while realizing the limitation of reason, we also can come to see reason more properly as a tool that serves the reason along with the power of God and his kingdom. Yes, sir.
I think in response to Alice's observation about abortion arguments versus death penalty, you could easily turn that on them and say, well, how can you say it's okay to kill an innocent human being and demand that a guilty one live? Yeah. And of course, they'll have a snarky answer for that, but
right.
But you can still go down the conversation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a foolish argument being posed in the first place. It's completely apples and oranges. If you're going to, I mean, there's something like killing, and they're trying to say, like, all killing is the same, as if the fifth commandment was thou shalt not kill. But in fact, it's thou shalt not murder. And there's a very important distinction to be made there. They probably won't have time for that, which is why we probably shouldn't spend a whole lot of time trying to convince them. what's that? Don't answer a fool according to his folly. Yeah, we have to do a little more of that, maybe. Shame people by refusing to even engage in their idiocy, because you granted a certain validity in engaging with it. All right. So are we still all believers in human justice? Probably not. How about E, down at the bottom of 93? As Heraclitus, this is the no man steps in the same stream twice guy. As Heraclitus saw, the only unchanging law, logos, isn't that interesting, is the law that all things change. This pantarei is Greek, everything flows. So constant, continuous change and instability is the only stability there is, paradoxically, or the only truth there is that there is no truth, or these kinds of assertions, which kind of gets you out of the typical rebuttal to these kinds of statements, because it doesn't deny all absolutes. It says there is one absolute, that there is no absolute. So it's a more sophisticated observation. Crave continues, true justice does not change, but that is not a thing. Our minds are spiritual things and change. Minds are not in space, but they are in time. We change our minds more often than we change our clothes, unless we are either professional models or very dull. So, yeah, and you can tell that this this observation is going to lead us right into the reason, because, you know, I'm rational, dadgummit. Well, not so much. And as we've already seen in this class earlier, usually the reason is drug along like a little girl holding onto a leash of a great big dog. There's a little control that reason can do, but not much. The passions, the emotions, something deeper lead the way, and then reason generally tags along. Now, we don't often think this about ourselves. Maybe especially this is a male thing, I don't know. We're not nearly as reasonable as we think we are. And here's one example, is that we change our minds all the time, and that things change all the time, and context changes all the time. And that, I mean, in a real sense, is actually why theology has to be done. Because why the Word of God, though it is still in and of itself, has to be applied to a given context that is constantly in flux. Otherwise, you just learn it and know it, and that would be it. Right? I could literally write down a name, a list of all the names of the people who attended the divine service, preach a sermon on baptism, and then say, you never need it again. Because it's static, and you're static, and I've given you the objective deposit, and you hold the objective deposit, and that's it. No more need. But we know that that's not how it works, because we're constantly in flux and change and up and down and remembering and forgetting and this challenge or that challenge. And so theology has to continue to be done. God's word, which is of itself static, has to continually be introduced, applicable to the context, which is in constant flux. Yes, sir.
Maybe parallel to that, I think that that's why positive law is a good thing, right? In the hands of a just magistrate, he's trying to respond to that specific context,
yeah.
Right? Ideally, he'd have as good a grasp as possible on true justice,
yeah.
And say, in this setting, how do we apply that?
Yeah.
No different than you would in your home, too, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. There's positive law in the home all the time. We're eating dinner at this time. Don't be late. And there's positive law all throughout the church. Christmas is on the 25th of December. Where's that written in the Bible? It's not. Where's that written in natural law? It's not. But that's when we're meeting. If you miss it, you miss it. So, yeah, there's positive law can get an overly bad rap. And in fact, we use it all the time. And I mean, this is kind of ironic too, because the antinomians, people who see legalism in everything always, are themselves every single day and in every aspect of their life legalistic, because they do things and they know there's a right way to do things and a wrong way to do things, and they have set patterns and habits, and they expect their families to be rightly ordered according to some arbitrary condition that they've set up. It's helpful to kind of peek underneath the ideological cover and see that we're all ordered creatures, which is to say legal creatures. And that's really a helpful insight too, is when you understand that the order of creation, and we're not just talking about the temporal order of creation, like God creates man and then woman. That's part of it. When I say order of creation, I mean the whole machinery of creation, the whole design of creation. That and the natural law are effectively the same thing, because God has designed it to work in a certain way, and the natural law is just saying this is the way it works, right? This is how God's universe is ordered. So these would be incorrect things because they function against the order. So a bicycle tire is meant to spin. If you stick a broom handle in it, that's disordered. You're going to end up going heel overhead. So too, this is the way the cosmos is ordered. If you try to fight against that, you're going to cause a disaster for yourself and for others. So natural law and order of creation are like, I mean, at most two sides of the same coin, but really in large part indistinguishable.
I don't want this to be a long digression, but I was reflecting the past few days that one of the things that our modern worldview, I guess I'd say, gets wrong is that we say that matter is the source of everything, and randomness is the thing that acted on that matter to bring us where we are today, when in fact intelligence definitionally has to be the source of everything,
right?
Because when you look at matter, there is order there, whether
exactly.
You're talking at the molecular level or subatomic level or wherever.
Exactly.
So if there is order, that by definition has to be the result or the product of intelligence. And so if intelligence rather than matter is at the root of all things,
mm-hmm.
Just that point alone shifts our thinking tremendously,
mm-hmm.
even without getting into who is that intelligence or what is it, mm-hmm. or where did it come from. Just that there is intelligence at the foundation of our existence, of the cosmos, it changes the questions we'd be asking ourselves, mm-hmm. either individually or as a society.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And when you get to sort of the fundamental elements of creation as we understand them, or even like the philosophy of mathematics and these kinds of things, you realize that all of this stuff is information and therefore is predicated upon one speaking or informing or thinking and writing those thoughts into creation so that they can be discovered. Yeah, it's becoming increasingly hard to be an atheist, that's for sure, if it ever was easy. So, yeah, that's wonderful. And then realizing too, I mean, I think it opens the potentiality not only to meditating upon implications of the fall, where things maybe don't seem to be functioning correctly, but likewise, where things don't fit the patterns we would expect, it opens the door to perceiving a higher kind of intelligence. Because what we, my children might perceive my words or attitudes as being chaotic or unpredictable, but I know exactly what I'm doing. They don't. And that is an insightful possibility, or interesting possibility, I mean, in terms of some of these questions we have, is the way that God thinks, it might all be completely rational, even though it appears to us to not make sense, or to be paradoxical, or to be two things at one time, right, seemingly, etc. Yeah, thanks for that comment. Really fruitful places to think. Okay, anything else you have in mind that you'd like to bring to the fore? Okay, so let's hit, I think that's Ponce 697. Does that sound right? Okay, good. Those who lead disorderly lives tell those who are normal that it is they who deviate from nature and think they are following nature themselves, just as those who are on board a ship think that the people on shore are moving away. And this is an interesting argument apologetically, because increasingly people will say, well, look at how the animals are. That's how we should be. No, you are not as you should be, and thus the animals are not as they should be, right? So it all exhibits this. It's just directionality. In any case, Pascal continues, language is the same everywhere. We need a fixed point to judge it. The harbor is the judge of those aboard ship, but where are we going to find a harbor in morals? Okay, so if you don't have, I mean, this is obvious, probably obvious to most of you. If you don't have God, you don't have morality. You've just got subjectivity. If you don't have God, you don't even have words, because there's no objectivity. There's just subjects making noises into the air, assuming other people think the same thing they're thinking, which may or may not be true. So apart from God, there's no such thing as meaning. There's no such thing as morality. Everything is relativistic, and anyone can make any claim they like about being more natural or more well-ordered than someone else who is less natural or less ordered. And we're just awash in subjectivity. So God is the, and this is where, like, I mean, not that we spend a lot of time listening to atheists, but this is just where, like, atheists can't even speak, because they have no, their own worldview is such that they don't believe they're communicating meaningful information. And if they do, on what basis? If they do think that they're communicating meaningful information one to another, on what basis do they believe that? The atheistic position is completely self-refuting at that level, and it's like where atheists, if they were true to form, would not open their mouths. If they actually believed or acted upon what they believe, they wouldn't open their mouths. Because why? And if it's all biologically or materialistically determined, then what's the point of even having a conversation in the first place? Because you're just determined to have your ideas, and the other person's determined to have their ideas. And whether or not you share that, whether or not it'll even be effective, is based on determinism, which is equally valid across the board. So our secular materialism, in other words, has also come to an end. And that's why people of all kinds are becoming more religious. Now, we would wish that they would become Christian, but it's why religiosity is spiking, and younger generations are giving up on even the sort of materialistic outlook. Well, that and they're broke. There's no money left, so they're forced to be philosophers. Okay, so let's take a look at Crafe's comment here. And I think we can skip to the last line of this first paragraph under 697, just to cut to the chase. Where but in God can we ever find this, quote, harbor in our morals? Thus, we return again to Dostoevsky's terrifying little truism: if there is no God, everything is permissible. The very things that lead many away from God, the problems of evil, injustice, ignorance, and relativity, are what Pascal uses to drive us in desperation to his arms. This is just like Luther in The Bondage of the Will, and it's why, like, it's mistaken to try to solve the quote-unquote problem of evil or injustice or ignorance or relativity. God doesn't want these things solved. They're his most powerful leverage points to drive men back to him. And I know that that sounds paradoxical, but that's exactly what Kraft is pointing out. The very things that lead many away from God are what Pascal uses to drive us in desperation to God's arms. Same with Luther, and again, same with, I think, theology that is much better than doing theodicy, trying to defend God on all of these things, is mistaken. Kraft continues, the atheist argues, if there were a God, how could there be injustice? To which Pascal replies, if there is injustice, there must be true justice for it to be relative to and a defect of. And this true justice is not found on earth or in man, therefore it must exist in heaven and God, either there or nowhere. And if nowhere, then everything is permissible. But not everything is permissible. Therefore, there must be a God. Pascal does not use this quote-unquote moral argument as an argument, but as a prod. And indeed, that's very wise, because all of these things, like this whole little nexus, the problems of evil, injustice, ignorance, relativity, etc., should be used as prods. They're not definitive. They're not like, oh, ergo, you have to believe in God or you deny your rationality. That's not how they work. But they work like, if you have the worldview you have impossible things to explain. And you're lost in an utter sea of meaninglessness, irrationality, amorality, and you're unable to answer those things. Ergo, you're driven from those things to God. Now, which God? And then you can enter into Christian apologetics proper. Okay, any thoughts you have there? Yes, do you have a thought? Yeah, please.
I'm not sure if this is pertinent, but I can't help but thinking how grateful I am for the Holy Spirit who grants us the faith, because as we learn more about God, we know he is just. And at the end of time, all justice will be served. So we as Christians have to try to keep ourselves from falling into despair, because we know what we deserve. And we know that in the promise of Christ, we're safe. But when you really start thinking about what should happen, mm-hmm. you can really fall into despair. So it's important, as you say, to study theology and know these are the promises of God and how we should live knowing that. But, you know, talking about ultimate justice, it's so easy to say, well, we're all just toast. Mm-hmm. It's over. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And the idea that we're all toast is an effective part of God's plan in binding all under sin, that he might have mercy on all in Christ Jesus. So that is axiomatic and kind of one of the most important truths of the scriptures, especially the New Testament.
But for those that have lived under grace for so long,
yeah,
it's easy to become complacent and say, well, that doesn't apply to me because I'm safe.
Oh,
so I'm
sure,
good to
yeah.
go. You know, you gotta still, the wages of sin is death. So
right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's a daily struggle
sin.
To present yourself as a slave to God instead of a slave to sin, as Paul talks about in Romans 6. Yeah, that's true. That's true. And the kind of relativistic quagmires that we find ourselves in and other people in. Like, I mean, you've probably had this experience where you're wronged in some kind of business deal or transaction or investment or some such thing. And if you really stop to think about, like, what is just, it's very elusive. Like, what does it mean to be made whole? It's very elusive. And even if you can kind of say, well, I'm out $50, so to be made whole is $50. Do you feel whole after that when you've spent another 24 hours trying to get that? You know, you're not whole. Who's going to compensate you for the time it took for you to achieve justice? And then other times, too, you go, like, I'm not even sure what justice looks like in this situation, because I'd have to know the inner heart, and I'd have to have some sort of scale of culpability, and I don't have access to any of these things. So this is where handing things over to God is the only wise thing to do, not only because he may be more lenient than we would incline to be, but also because he may be more harsh than we would incline to be. And in any case, he's the only one that could render a perfectly objective justice. None of us could. So, yeah, all of that is illustrative of what Pascal's talking about, too. So thank you. Okay, so 699 on page 95. When everything is moving at once, nothing appears to be moving, as on board a ship. When everyone is moving towards depravity, no one seems to be moving. But if someone stops, he shows up the others who are rushing on by acting as a fixed point. Okay, so this is where a whole culture can rush off the cliff without realizing that's what it's doing. And the only way to realize this, I mean, Kraft lets his Roman Catholicism shine through here in the worst possible way. He thinks the fixed points are saints. I don't know about that. Maybe Jesus. he says only a fixed point, I'm right in the middle of the paragraph, he says only a fixed point above the flow of time and history can judge the flow. Concretely, these fixed points are the saints. Yeah, I don't know about that. How about Jesus, who is above the flow of time and history and can judge such a flow? There's kind of a neat analogy to the stars of heaven and the saints, and yeah, in a relative sort of way, I get it. But I don't think we should ascribe to the saints that which belongs to Jesus alone. Okay, the whole point being that, yes, we can, this is where organizations can have tremendous drift without anyone recognizing it, who's inside the organization or of like mind. So without stability, an external objective stability, justice flows along, cultures flow along, organizations flow along, and it's never in a, ultimately it's never in a good way. All right, that takes us to the vanity of human reason, which is really just a necessary corollary of the vanity of justice. I mean, what is justice going to be based on if not reason? So if justice is awry, reason's going to be awry. And that's the natural ordering here, I think, of Kraft in putting these two subchapters next to each other. So let's just wade in here. Pascal deflates human reason not to establish skepticism, and not to demean the mind God made in us as part of his own image, but for the same reason he deflated human justice. De jure, justice is great. So that is, de jure is like in a rightful or proper sense. Justice is great. De facto, and what he's going to mean by de facto is like in concrete or in human practice, it is weak. Okay, so right, in reality, justice, as we were just describing, as God can execute it, is great. It's perfect, it's holy, it's fair unto the uttermost. But as we try to instantiate that, it's very weak. Okay, he continues, natural law is great. The ordering of the cosmos, the morality that's inherent in the cosmos. Natural law is great, but human law, really he means the application, the human application of the natural law is weak. Similarly, reason de jure in itself or in its rightful or proper sense is going to be great. Reason essential, reason in its nature is great. But reason de facto, reason existential, reason in its exercise is weak and pushed around by passion, imagination, habit, diversion, and random chance. Yeah, so these things, like we said earlier, are the tail wagging the dog if we think the dog is reason. We're not rational creatures, first and foremost, no matter how much we might wish that to be the case. Okay, so then, I mean, as we move along, you're going to see him. He's going to take each one of these topics, passion, imagination, habit, diversion, and random chance, and show how they rule reason in ways they shouldn't, but they just do. Craig continues, there have always been two emphases in Christian philosophy, the Augustinian emphasis on the existential inadequacy and wretchedness of natural things like human reason. Obviously, Luther is an Augustinian, and we're of the Lutheran tradition, so this is why we have a very similar, I mean, we're right at home with this reflection of what that reason itself is wretched and is bound up in sin and antipathy toward God. So there's a wretchedness of natural things like human reason, justice, and philosophy. And again, not per se or de jure, but de facto in reality. The two, or expressed in reality, I mean. The two emphases are opposites, but complementary. Oh, I skipped over. I'm sorry. Where did I leave off? After the semicolon, fourth line from the top of that paragraph. And the Thomistic. So, okay, one side of the coin, Augustinian, the other side of the coin, Thomistic. We are not familiar with the Thomistic side of things. And the Thomistic emphasis on the essential adequacy and greatness of these things. Now, the key word there being essential, because we're not going to disagree with that. The two emphases are opposites but complementary. They do not contradict but complete each other. By temperament and emphasis, Pascal is Augustinian. So were Paul, Luther, Dostoevsky, Kierkegaard, and many of the saints. So he psychologized this a little bit by saying temperament. And insofar as he psychologizes it, he's probably got a point to one degree or another. Pascal's strategy in deflating reason, rather I should say deflating reason's pretensions, can best be stated by quoting these lines by W.B. Yeats. Now that my ladder's gone, I must lie down where all ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. His strategy is not architectural, but spelunking. He does not build a tower, but digs a cave, explores the heart and the heart's road to God. This is the necessary strategy today because reason's ladder to God is gone for most people. Remember, apologetics is not just science, not just statements of objective truth. It is seduction, it is matchmaking, it is spying. And if you remember from the earlier chapters, Crave saying this is virtually entirely what it is, because we are, even culturally speaking, as modern pagans or as Christians living in a modern pagan society, reason has never been valued at a lower level than perhaps in our own culture, which is like what you feel, what you want, what you will. And so to emphasize like rationality and rational arguments is a mistake. Instead, we should view the apologetic process of matchmaking or spying out and subverting, right? Okay, just a little further and then we'll call it a day. Reason's ladder is far thinner today because of what happened in Pascal's day under Bacon, Descartes, and the Great Darkness, universally misnamed the Enlightenment. reason narrowed from wisdom to science. And that's so true. And just one of the worst intellectual developments of the Enlightenment is... and now we're just told religiously, trust the science. Like the scientific method? No, what we tell you. All right, so wisdom devolves to science. We go from understanding to calculation, to totally different things. From exploring mysteries to solving problems. And this, I'll just make a final kind of comment here. This has infected theology with disastrous result. That if we perceive of theology as solving problems or making calculations or sharp axiomatic definitions, we've missed the whole point. Now, those things can be helpful, but they have to be seen as part of a whole, and the whole is exploring mysteries. God is himself a mystery, and all of his teachings are mysteries. And St. Paul says this very thing, that God should account us, he means the apostles and the apostolic ministry, as stewards of the mysteries of God. So theology is the exploration of mystery, of which all these other things are lesser and apart. Okay, so... just picking up where we left off quickly, Descartes implicitly redefines reason in the very first sentence of his enormously influential Discourse on Method by declaring it equal in all men. And this is why you've heard me, one of the reasons why you've heard me trace the radical egalitarian of our age back to the Enlightenment, because it begins here at these, I'm trying to be polite, wildly foolish assertions like reason is equal in all men. Like, have you talked to anyone ever? Okay. But this is what Descartes thinks. And this sets up the whole tabula rasa, the whole blank slate thing, and that it's just, it has nothing to do with nature, it has everything to do with nurture. So if you just give everybody enough money and opportunity, everybody's going to have the same outcome. Would be hard to imagine a more foolish thing. Okay, so Descartes declares reason equal in all men, something obviously untrue of wisdom and obviously true of the laws of logic. Well, that, yeah, de jure, but not de facto. This newly narrowed, sharpened, laser-like, this worldly reason is a poor power for climbing Jacob's ladder to heaven. That is, for Pascal's purpose in the Pensées. Jacob's ladder is explained in John 1:51. You remember that? In fact, even the older, broader, deeper, fuller reason is not sufficient for that. As freely admitted by the most rational of all Christian theologians, St. Thomas, I don't know that we have to necessarily agree with that assessment, but even like the book of Job would show you this. So that the reason and knowledge, and even more than reason, let's say, knowledge of God has to come to an end at some point, and God simply must be God, and he simply must be embraced and experienced. If the limit or even the goal is to know everything there is to know about God, well, God is infinite. The only way to do that is if you know something that is infinite, then you yourself have to be infinite. And so we see that the pursuit of the knowledge of God can very easily become the pursuit of one's own deity and a failed attempt. Yes, sir, we'll let you have the last word of the day. As long as it's a decent one.
No promises. If God is infinite and we can't know the infinite, would it be fair to say that we could at least attempt to understand how he's revealed himself through Jesus?
That's the whole goal. Yeah, absolutely. So in the revelation that God gives us of himself in his word, as Hebrews says, in many and various ways he spoke to his people of old by the prophets. Now in these last days he has spoken to us by his son. And through his son, the apostolic scriptures. So you have the prophetic scriptures and the apostolic scriptures. This is the revelation of God and the boundaries in which we can know him. And those scriptures themselves, I mean, this is kind of paradoxical, but as the revealed knowledge of God themselves indicate that there is knowledge of God that is unrevealed and or impossible for creatures to grasp. All right, next week, 97, and let's just say we're going to go to 104. I'll be surprised if we get that far, but 97 to 104. The Lord be with you.